Blog Talk Radio.
Home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen, coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Gosh golly, the stars just keep coming out of the woodworks this week, and tonight is going to be just like the rest of the week. We are blessed and honored tonight to have Robert Michael Morris. He's going to be on the show with us in just a minute. I'm going to properly introduce him, but I want to give a big shout-out and thanks to Kurgan Edward Stout for introducing us on Facebook a while back. And I finally was able to get Robert Michael Morris to join us tonight and be part of the show. I want to remind everybody for tomorrow night's Friday Night Dance Party, make sure you're tuning in early. We're doing a special 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time start time to have Broadway star Kaffir on the line with us. He has been on Phantom of the Opera for ages and ages. He's leaving that now, and we're going to find out all about that and his new album that he promises to tell us about tomorrow night. But tonight, we are delighted and thrilled and honored to have Robert Michael Morris join the show. You'll know him as his role in Mickey in the critically acclaimed show The Comeback with Lisa Kudrow. He also played Will Arnett's nanny on Fox's Running Wild. He's been on Will and Grace, Arrested Development, How I Met Your Mother, Community Service, Two Broke Girls, and most recently created the role of Truman Dubois in Lesbie Friends. So, Robert Michael Morris, welcome to the show. Wow!
Well, thank you very much that you skipped one of my favorite ones.
Let's see, The Class and Brothers and Sisters and Warren the Ape.
Brothers and Sisters, that's it. I mean,
I work
with Sally Field, I want to tell you.
Oh, my gosh. What an honor is that?
Mm-hmm. Two-time Oscar winner, yes. And I like her. I really like her.
Of course. So, now, is it okay if I call you Michael on the show tonight?
Oh, sure. That's fine. Sure.
Okay, cool. So, for everybody who knows who you are but doesn't really know your backstory, can you tell us a little bit about your role as, because, you know, you're celebrating your 10th anniversary this year of being an actor in Hollywood, or, you know, quote-unquote being famous, but you have a history in the theater and everything else. So tell us about yourself.
Oh, well, Lord, where do I begin? Well, let's start at the beginning. It was in a small radio station in Tarzana. No, I'm kidding. I was born in a town smaller than Tarzana, in Ludlow, Kentucky, and from a poor but semi-dishonest family, and left home when I was 18 to join a religious order of men who were teachers, and I did that for 10 years, and then I went on a national tour playing Midsummer Night's Dream and the Oresteia. Finished my master's degree in playwriting at Catholic University of America. Taught in Erie, Pennsylvania I went out on tour after that, getting my degree, with Taming of the Shrew, The Miser, and The Trial, all in rec. That was great fun. And then I went to Erie, Pennsylvania and taught at Gannon University and ran their theater program for 5 years, then moved to New York for 10. I was stage manager on Cloud 9 with more stars than they have at Warner Brothers. I mean, I was one of the first hires, and I stayed until the show ended.
Wow.
And worked with some amazing talent. And then I taught in Urbana, Ohio, at Urbana University, ran their theater program. Then I went to back to Erie, Pennsylvania, and taught at Mercyhurst College, ran their theater program. Then I went to Urbana, Illinois, Lafayette, Indiana, with one of my former students from Urbana. It was doing a .com company. He
okay.
said I would be a millionaire in a year, and I wasn't, so I left. And I've been in California since then.
So, okay, so can you answer me this? Because I kind of read through your biography a little bit earlier tonight. You have been and lived in more places than I can count on two hands put together. What is it about your journey in life that has led you to be such a nomad?
Well, maybe it's genetic. My father always figured that if he kept moving, they couldn't catch him. But if you're in theater, you are essentially a gypsy anyway. You go where the work is. And that's pretty much what I did. I went where the work was. And when when the work ended, I had to find someplace else to go, so I went there. And I came out here because my brother had been out here for 30-some years.
Oh.
And said to me, they need teachers in California. So I actually came out here to be a teacher.
Oh, okay.
And I had no intention of doing showbiz. And when my job, I taught at a girls' school 1 year. I taught at a different girls' school for 2 years. And then they cut way back. They got rid of half of the English department. And by that time, I had an MFA. I had 25 years teaching experience. So my salary was on the high end. They let me go.
Oh, okay.
And I was working for my brother. He has a medical supply place, durable medical goods. And I was working in the warehouse cleaning oxygen concentrators with three Cambodians.
Nice.
And,
you don't run into that opportunity every day.
It's wonderful. It was really terrific. They were really nice guys. And then I got a call from Michael Patrick King, who said, because I knew him from when we lived in New York. I lived like six doors down from him by accident. And I had seen his work when he was in college. And he said, I'm working on a show with Lisa Kudrow, and there's a part in it I think you might be right for, but I can't guarantee anything, and it could damage our friendship, but I think you should go for it. And I knew what he meant. He didn't. He meant that if I didn't get it,
don't
hit
his
guts.
Yeah.
So I said, sure. So I went to the audition. I was early, as I usually am, and I didn't know anybody in the room but Michael. And I said to Michael on the phone, I said, after they sent me the sides, I said, now should I arrive in character, or do you want me to become the character in front of them? He said, I think it'd be more fun if you came in character. So I tried to put together a kind of a costume, and I brought a lot of rings and stuff. But I got there so early that I didn't have time to put any of the jewelry on, and they said, well, somebody cancel, you go on right away. So I went in, and we did the reading. I did the reading with Lisa, and they said, thank you. I said, you know, I brought all this stuff with me, but I didn't want to wear it because I was afraid if I had an accident, they'd take me to Silver Lake. They did what you're doing. They laughed. And there is a feeling that you get when you know you have the audience.
Right, right.
And I knew I got that feeling. And somebody said, well, tell us about the rings. And I did. And then somebody else said something. I recognized Michael saying something. And then they said, okay, thank you. And I had, when I was teaching high school in San Gabriel, I had, for my English girls, it was a girls' school, and I bought little cubic zirconias on a silver chain, which I had on my desk on one of those velvet neck forms you see in jewelry stores.
Oh,
and
sure,
I said,
yeah.
Whoever has the highest average at the end of the semester will get this beautiful piece of jewelry made especially for you. And, I mean, you do anything you can when you're teaching, you know. That was.
Oh, sure, you bet.
But I had a couple of them left over, so I put one of them, for some reason, in a little packet. I put one in my pocket. So when they said, okay, thanks very much for coming in, and I stood up, and I looked at Lisa, and I said, now, Mickey wouldn't have come to see you without bringing you something, so here. And I held packet. And she came over and she said, oh, my God, it's beautiful. I said, don't get excited. It's not real. And she said, who's going to get close enough? And I thought, when I left, I thought, well, that was, they were all very nice. And John Melfi and Dan Bukatinski and Lisa and the casting people. I thought, this was really, what a great story. And I went right back to cleaning concentrators with the Cambodians.
There you go.
And then I get a call that I had a comeback, a callback, rather. So I went to the callback at HBO Studios, which was like their offices. It was like walking into the sets of Gattaca.
Oh, my gosh.
White and lucite. And, well, remember, I'm from a very small town in Kentucky, and I was agog. So I go upstairs, and Lisa meets me at the top of the stairs, and she says, look. And she's wearing the...
Oh, come on. That is great.
And she said, I'm wearing this for good luck. So we went in, and we all had to sign contracts. And they had one other guy for the Mickey role and one other guy for the Mark role. There was like two people for every role that they were trying to cast.
Okay.
The only one two there was Laura Silverman. They pretty much decided on her right away. And we went in for the reading, and it was like a little amphitheater there. And I cannot tell you to this day whether there were 15 or 500. I was so nervous and so focused that I didn't know. If they had been on fire, I might have noticed it, but I didn't notice. So I did the reading with them, and then they said, thank you all very much for coming. And I thought, oh, what a great story. This is another great story. How lucky can a guy get?
Uh-huh.
So I go, and I'm in the warehouse, I'm in the, my brother's building, and I'm answering phones that day. And the phone call comes in, and they go over the intercom. Michael, there's a call for you on line one. And I heard my brother running through the warehouse. And my agent at the time, because they got me an agent, because I didn't have an agent. And my agent called, and they said, have you heard anything yet? And I said, nope, not a word. I didn't expect it. She said, well, your life's about to change. You got it.
Wow.
And I said, what? My brother said, I turned so beet red, he thought I was having a stroke. It was my first audition, my first audition in Los Angeles, and I got the part of Mickey in The Comeback.
Well, can I tell you, I sat down and I went on YouTube and tried to do some researching today, and there's a clip of you and Lisa out there. It's called the Lisa and... Or the it's the Mickey clip, you know, and it's 15 minutes of you and Lisa interacting in various scenes throughout the course of the season, and I nearly peed my pants. I almost needed to have Depends on because the clips were just hysterical.
Well, she's so wonderful to work with, I want to tell you. And I will say this, and I will say this unabashedly. If she doesn't get an Emmy nomination, and if she doesn't win the damn Emmy, I'm going to burn something down. I mean,
well, you heard her here first. She's great.
It's amazing. It's amazing. What she goes from so many emotions in just a matter of seconds. It's right in her face. You know, when you're working with her, it's right there in her eyes. She's so generous as a performer and easy and relaxed. I adore her anyway. And which makes it so easy to play Mickey because Mickey really loves her. I've said before that if he was straight, he'd be in love with her.
Right.
She's marvelous. She's just marvelous to work with.
Well, one of the things that I got such a huge kick out of is just because it's been, you know, a hot minute since I've seen, you know, the episodes, but throughout the course of the whole, season, you know, you have Mickey really trying to make sure that the fact that he's gay doesn't get out to the whole world. And it's the worst kept secret ever. And it's just hysterical. And it's like, you know, the only person who doesn't see it is him.
Well, yeah. I mean, because I don't think Mickey puts people in boxes. He doesn't go by labels. And he's very subtle in his expression of his preference. But anybody with, you know, Stevie Wonder would know that Mickey was gay.
Absolutely.
He doesn't. He's just who he is. He's a
right.
little flamboyant. He's flamboyant, but he doesn't see it as a sexual thing. The fact that he's been living with a lover for all those years doesn't dawn on him.
Well, it's almost like he's old school. You might have your partner and you might be gay and you might whatever, but it's not something you ever talk about in public. But for the Charles Nelson Reillys of the world or the Paul Lynds of the world, you know, everybody knew, but it was, you know, nobody talked about it, but it was the worst kept secret everywhere.
Mickey was sort of the John Gielgud of America.
Perfect. Yes. Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, that's been a little bit of time. We had the reunion show, but we had the new season this year. As far as that goes, have you heard anything new and exciting that you can share with us about the comeback?
Well, you're going to have to twist my arm, let me tell you.
Okay.
I got an invitation to the Golden Globes after party that HBO threw. And boy, do they know how to throw a party. And I said to Michael, what should I say if they ask me if there's going to be a third season? He said, just say HBO has left the door open.
Of course. There
because
we go.
I know HBO would like more of them. I know from reading an interview that Lisa gave with ABC that she wants to do more. But I think they probably want to take some time to really think about where it could go from here. Because in the end, at the end of the first 13, which were not easy to watch, but neither is Long Day's Journey and Tonight, it was like a play. There was a definite arc to the to what happened with her. And, Michael's from theater. He's got a theater base. So when he writes, I think, with that. He sees the end and the middle and the beginning, you know, and at the end of the play, of the first 13, she gets what she wants. She succeeds. She's a success. Now, at the end of this one, she wins an Emmy. Her marriage is back on solid footing. So she... No matter what Pauly G tried to put her through in this last eight show season, she triumphed. She succeeded. Remember early on in the first season, she does that wonderful thing about "To I Will Survive."
Right. And you guys are dancing in the recording studio.
That's Valerie Jerry. She is a survivor. and she might be a little myopic. like Mr. Magoo was a little myopic. But her heart was always in the right place. And see, I think that's why. See, Mickey knows that. Mickey knows how sweet and good she is. And when it looks on the surface like she's being cool or mean, she's not. I mean, Mickey can see that she's not. He knows what's inside her. And this last eight showed people what Mickey knew all along. She's a very sweet person. So for her to leave the Emmy and go to see Mickey in the hospital, the penultimate moment of her life, and she gives it up because she's more concerned about somebody else, boy, oh boy.
Well, I really think that the whole relationship between them, because it goes back, like it says at the beginning of the series, you've been her stylist since, what was it, 90, 92, 93, and you talk about the series that she was on at that time. So you've seen her, quote unquote, naked and without the makeup and without any of the pretense. And, you've dolled her up and you've made her beautiful. So you see what's really behind the surface. And I think that really why Mickey's able to love her, because he knows who she really is?
Of course. And it's not like you have to love your child. I mean, he can walk away anytime he wants to. But
sure.
He's been doing her hair for 25 years.
Yeah.
And you just don't walk away from that. No, he adores her. He just adores her.
He adores him.
At the very end, when Mickey hands her that remote, and she takes it like it's the Emmy, and she says, I'd like to thank the two most important men in my life. And it's her husband And it's Mickey.
Yeah, yeah. It speaks volumes.
Yeah, and it was a very tender, wonderful moment, I thought. You know? And you do you remember the exit music for the last episode?
Not off the top of my head, so I apologize for that, Michael. Refresh me.
Cherish is a word that used to that.
Oh, the Madonna song.
No, not Madonna.
No. Oh, cool. Cherish, like Cool and the Gang. Sorry.
I don't know who it was by, but it's a group. You know, Cherish is the word. So yeah, and I thought that was a sweet moment too. You know. But I'll tell you, one of the things I love, these little stories. First of all, I love theater stories. I love theater stories, and I love dirt. But go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, have such a huge history in theater. I wanted to make sure that we got a chance to talk about that, because you've written over 91 scripts, and, you know, been everywhere. So.
Well, let's not talk about that right now. Let me give you this little story.
Okay, cool.
This last 8 shows we did, they were like miracles. First of all, never in the history of television has there ever been a reunion show after 10 years, a series being returned with the original cast members. Everybody was there.
Well, it's such a good show, you have to do it.
I know. Well, you couldn't do it if somebody died. You couldn't do it if somebody had become a man.
Yeah, right.
And so it was amazing. And we got their house back. The people that remember it was the same house that we used in the first 13.
Do you know what was involved in getting that?
Oh no! I don't have any idea. You know, I'm first of all, I'm no good with numbers, and then. I took a bunch of stuff up with me, you know, jewelry, and in fact, I bought more stuff to wear on the show because I said to Michael, you know, I think after 10 years, Mickey's into necklaces. So I had a different necklace, and I bought some to take up, and I bought more rings and cuffs and crap. And, I mean, I like to do that. Again, that's my theater training. You know, you bring it with you.
And right.
And I had bought a red blazer at a store, and I used to say that, yeah, I can park cars at any hotel in L.A. And then I found a pair of matching red slacks online. So I bought them and a pair of red shoes. So I took them up there, and I gave them to wardrobe, and they said, oh, it might be a bit much. And so they had them, and I said to Michael one time, I said, Michael, Did wardrobe show you the red suit? And his eyes got as big around as Bambi in the forest. And he said, I don't believe this. I had a dream last night that Mickey was wearing a red suit in the infomercial. But I thought, where's wardrobe going to find a red suit in 2 days? And I said, Michael, I brought one with me.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, that's the kind of miracle, wonderful stuff that happened. And being able to get Seth Rogen and it was a miracle show, really was.
Well, and you've also been on the Fox show, which I think it had a very short run, but I loved it. It was called Running Wild. What was your experience like with that?
Well, we worked in a mansion in Long Island, I guess, or New Jersey, something like that. But it was one of the robber barons' houses.
Oh.
And so it was fabulous, and it was really a wonderful experience. I mean, Kerry Russell is absolutely an angel person, and that little girl that played Puddle from New Zealand was just darling, and her mother was there with her all the time, and her sister, who's older than she is by 2 years, and is a gorgeous little girl, and I met some really wonderful, wonderful people working on that show. But I remember we had a talk back on like a you know, after an interview line outside, interviews with all the different people. Then we were on stage at Hunter or someplace. And somebody said to me, what's the difference between working with Lisa Kudrow and Will Arnett? And I thought, damn, is that a loaded question? Boy, am I fucked. I was told I guess I can say that.
No, you're fine. This is online, so you're good.
Anyway, so I just took a beat and I said, well, for one thing, she's a woman. And that kind of, I could say anything I wanted to then. But, you know, it was a really good experience in many, many ways.
So what happened to the show? Because it was on and then it was gone. Did they just say this just isn't fit? Or
you know, I don't know. I really don't know. First of all, I cannot figure out the inscrutable minds that say, yes, let's do this. And then, I mean, there are some of these nitwits that run these networks. Oh, I'll never work again. But they leave a show on for 3 episodes and then pull it.
I mean, millions of dollars.
And not only that, it really screws around with people's lives.
Oh, yeah.
But it was a very, very, I thought, a decent enough show, but it didn't find an audience for some reason.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, you've been on 2 shows that I think were really very cute. You know, you've come back critically acclaimed. Everybody loves it. It's a spectacular show. Writing is great. And then you have this other show, you know, Running Wild, which I thought was just adorable. You know, and if you'd seen any of the episodes, it's a predictable format, but it was funny. Do you think that the networks, you know, because they'll invest, you know, years in shows like the Dancing with the Stars, which is in season 800, or the Amazing Race season 900, or, you know, whatever. They have these crazy things that they go on and do, but you have these shows that are actually entertaining, like Running Wild or The Comeback, and, you know, they just don't seem to have very long legs. Why do you think that is? I mean, you're an insider now, so you know.
Oh, right, insider. Well, I would say change the word entertaining to scripted.
Okay.
You know, and that I think is the difference. Now, the people working on Running Wild were the same geniuses that did Arrested Development. They were not Johnny Come Latelys. This wasn't their first rodeo. And they were nice scripts. And they had some wonderful directors working on that show. Who can say? I watch shows and I go, how in the heck can that be on television?
Right.
And then other shows, you go, what? Why was that taken off? I don't know. I don't get it. I really don't get it. So I don't try anymore.
Okay, fair enough. But there's one show that you have been on, and I try to catch it whenever I can, but I'm going to tell you, I probably have missed it. But you were on Two Broke Girls, one of the most body inappropriate, suggestive shows on TV, and I laugh my head off every time I see the show. So, you know,
Spider is.
I don't think I do. Who is it, Michael?
Well, I think it's Michael Patrick King.
Oh, gee, there you go. How does that work?
It was created by Michael Patrick King, and oh, God, I'm going to mess up her name. Wesley Cummings, is that her name?
She
made a show that I thought was really cute, and it didn't last. So I can't figure it out. And I know some people go, oh, I can't stand that Two Broke Girls. And I keep saying,
I love it.
I love the way they push the envelope, and I love the chemistry between the two girls.
Absolutely.
And I love all the supporting people. They're all really good. Yes, it's raunchy. Well, there's enough people in America who really enjoy a little raunch. And let's face it, it's pretty innocent raunch. If you want to see anything that's really, really raunchy, get cable. This is a network.
There you go. That's
show.
What cable's for, absolutely. Now, what character did you play on Two Broke Girls? Because did you play a neighbor?
No. I played, I'll never remember the guy's name. He was an antique dealer. And
that's
he had
right.
a little doll, Miss Pickles.
That's right, that's right, that's right. Okay. That was a great episode.
Oh, yeah. And I don't know if this is a funny story, but I guess I can say this. But I went to the read-through, and originally I was supposed to be the auctioneer.
Oh, okay.
And then when I went in the next day, they said, you're no longer the auctioneer. And I said, oh, crap, what did I do? And they said, they wrote this character because they said, he's so good, he's got to have a scene with the girl. So they wrote that whole little scene where we were bidding against each other, Fred Savage directed that. And
yeah,
talk about a nice guy, you know, because like I was like a little bit in awe of him. Michael is still working his ass off. He was doing that show while we were doing the comeback.
Oh my gosh, the man never slept.
He probably didn't. No. I'm afraid he has a portrait in his closet that keeps getting older because he looks funny.
Michael, you are. I love your sense of humor. You are a dear man. So can we go back and can I? Because we have not met before tonight. And number one, I want to take you to lunch or and spend time with you outside of the show. So I'm going to just throw that out there publicly because I want to know more. And because your history is just so rich and dripping with these gems of things that you've done in your life. Starting with
it's
not that exciting, Gary. Well, it reads it here. So tell me about the Society of Mary, because it was like raised in Kentucky and you go to the Society of Mary.
Well, I went to Covington Catholic High School, which was a high school that was run by the Marianist brothers, and I really became enamored of the brothers because. I really hated high school. I mean, this is before they invented bullying. But I had a homeroom teacher, and I'm going to say his name because he's dead, and I hope he's roasting somewhere. But his name was Owen Patrick Gleason, and he was our shit ass. And when I would go in, he never called me Michael. He always called me Mary.
Really?
How do you like that? You know,
I would not have liked that. No way.
No. And he had this little group of guys that were his like little gang of four or five.
Uh-huh.
And their trick was they would get the window pole. Remember window poles when you used to open the window from the top? They used to get a window pole and they would put it between your legs and they would lift you up on their shoulders and carry you around the classroom. To
what?
The Gale. Oh, yes. I want to tell you. I used to throw up in the morning walking to school because I knew what I was in for. But what saved me was my Irish sense of humor, my verbal skills, and the brothers of the Society of Mary.
Mm.
And they treated me like a human being. They encouraged my writing, and I wanted to be just like them. I wanted to be good and holy and save the world and help people. I mean, I was so Catholic back then, you know, the Vatican.
How Catholic were you?
Oh, I was so Catholic, Ed. I had a Catholic grade school, Catholic high school. I went to Catholic University of America and the University of Dayton for my college.
Wow.
You know, and I had perpetual vows. I wore a religious habit. I taught in high school. I taught religion.
Well, yeah, you taught in seven high schools in your career and then the two universities. So did when you went to college – okay, I'm going to back up here because I have 40 questions here. So did you start writing when you were in high school, and is that where you – decided, okay, this is something that I really want to pursue, or what was your scholastic experience like that motivated you?
Well, I'll tell you. I wrote in high school for the school magazine and stuff like that, and I was just writing for approval.
Okay.
And I didn't get a lot of it, but I did it anyway. It was an outlet. And then when I had never been in a play in my life until I went to what we call the Scholasticate, which was the year after the novitiate for the Society of Mary. And the brothers, the young brothers, used to, as an extracurricular, put on plays. Usually it was Shakespeare or something. But the first play I ever did in my life was Eleanor Hilliard. I was 19 years old. I was real thin. I looked like death eating a cracker. And I played the Martha Scott role in Desperate Hours.
How do you, or were you nervous, or how did you overcome? I guess from somebody who would just be myself terrified at that point to even be, you know, if you've been bullied, try to have any kind of spotlight shined on myself. How did you say, okay, I'm going to get on stage and people are going to see me?
Well, you know, I think it's because I'm stupid.
Well,
I never.
You know, ignorance is bliss.
I never thought of it. Because here's the thing, too. Once I joined the Society of Mary, I felt safe.
Oh, okay.
I felt like I had come home, but I was not afraid of anything. And, of course, when you take religious vows, you know, everything that you need is given to you. You don't need money because mm-hmm. what you need is given to you, you know, and you don't have to worry about where you're going to go because they tell you where you're going to go and what you're going to do. And so it was, I just felt totally relaxed and home. And the second play that we did in this class, and I started directing it, but I had to drop out. I was taking 28 hours a semester.
Oh, my gosh.
And so Ed Smith took over, and we were doing Witness for the Prosecution. And nobody would shave their legs to do that little girl role at the end of the show that turns the tables on the husband, this whole house. And so we decided that, the more like a tart we could make this character, the better. So there I am on stage. I mean, I looked like a Ukrainian hooker. I had big hands and this yellow two-piece dress and a platinum wig. And well, after the first performance, the big boss says to the director or to the master scholastic, either tone her down or take her out. So I was told that, and we only had two performances scheduled. So the next day I appeared on stage with a black velvet bow in my hair, a black sack dress. So I went from, tart of the world to, Pollyanna.
So, and what was the feedback from that?
Oh, nothing. It was over. It was only just.
Oh, it's over and done. Okay.
What I did find out later, when I was finally sent out into community, because this is all what we consider formation. We had to get our undergraduate degrees. And when I was sent out to my first teaching position, a letter went from the main area saying not to be engaged in dramatics.
And what does that mean?
Well, that meant I wasn't supposed to be involved with the shows they did at the school.
Why?
Because they thought maybe it was not good for my vocation, and I might want to, I might want to leave and get on RuPaul's Drag Race or something. I don't know what they thought.
Oh my gosh, that's wild.
Back in the 60s. But I started writing when I was in the Scholasticate, and when I was at, it was very religious oriented, like little Christmas pageants and stuff like that. And I wrote
sure.
Christmas and Easter things for the high school boys to do. And then somehow, because this I don't think is in my anything you read, but the Diocese of Pittsburgh was given an hour of community service time. And they were going to do it to explain the new catechism. Sister Mary Michael was going to be the moderator. And I said at the meeting, I said, well, for God's sake, please make it as interesting as Lamp Unto My Feet. Because I remembered that show from when I was a kid in Kentucky watching it on television on our little Dumont you know, television, black and white.
Sure.
And so I got, they involved me, and I would write the intro to what they would be discussing, the lesson plan for that day. And I decided to do it all with dance. Now, here's how much I knew about dance. Nothing. You know, God protects idiots and babies, and I was the idiot. And then there was a priest in Pittsburgh, a wonderful man, who did a lot of stuff for the Chancery Lane Players, but he called me and he said, Brother Mike, I keep getting requests from ladies, you know, altar society groups, and they want a show, but I do Broadway. Could you put together something religious? So I put together this little thing of four or five of the shows, and I had two girls from St. Benedict's and the boys from North Catholic. And here's what the boys from North Catholic knew about dance. Nothing.
Nothing.
But they trusted me. And I had watched enough of Martha Graham on Omnibus, and so I didn't know what I was doing. But we traveled around the whole Pittsburgh area doing these little shows for ladies' altar societies. You know, and it was wonderful. The kids loved it. And it was great. It was just wonderful. I did that for like about 3-4 years in Pittsburgh.
Wow. How fun.
Oh, you look back and you go, what the hell was I thinking? You know, I mean, I'm not Brian Williams, but I wasn't lying. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing, but nobody said, do you know what you're doing? So I just kept doing it. And every once in a while, I'll see things on television to remind me. I fly back. I wrote something once when it was like the big civil rights was going on back then. And they had this old statue of the Sacred Heart, a little statue up 3 feet high of the Sacred Heart. And the opening of my segment was someone taking a sledgehammer and slamming it on the head of the Sacred Heart.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
All that stayed up was most of the body, but the two hands pointing to the heart. And then dancing and went on around it. And one of the names mentioned was Mrs. Viola Luiso, which I just heard the other day because she was one of the, in Selma, she was one of the, she was a white woman from Pittsburgh who was killed in the Ku Klux Klan thing. And it just threw me right back to TV show.
Oh, my gosh.
See, when you live long enough and you've got a good memory, you get pulled up short a lot.
So, well, let me ask you, how do you keep your memory sharp? Because I find, especially in the last, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 months, I forget things. I'll go into one room with a specific intent to get a coffee cup or something, and I'll get in there and, like, I have no idea why I'm here, not a clue. So as an actor, how do you work on staying sharp and remembering your lines?
That happens to me. Well, that happens to me all the time, walking into a room. What am I doing here? Or I'll start something, and I go, what was I doing? Oh, and then
right.
I take it. But that's my great fear, is forgetting lines. I'm absolutely phobic about that. And yet, I can remember lines from plays that I did 20 years ago. I mean, I don't have any idea. I didn't do a lot of drugs, unless you want to consider alcohol a drug, but I didn't do a lot of drugs, and I was really very, very blessed by having wonderful things happen to me that just kept me going. You know, can you imagine? Here I am in New York, and I had done work at Kenley Players in Ohio back when the fabulous John Kenley had his summer theater. And I worked in two different shows, with Tommy Tune. And when he was doing Cloud Nine in New York at the Lucille Ortel, he called me and said, would you like to be an understudy? So I was understudy, and then I was doing all kinds of musical crap backstage. And then And then somebody finally said after about a week's rehearsal, geez, what are we going to do if Michael ever has to go on? There'll be no one backstage to do that. I said, look, I'm very happy doing what I'm doing. You can get somebody else. And they got somebody else to be understudy. But I was with that show from the beginning to end, and it was because I worked with Tommy Toon at Tenley Players, and I got the job at Tenley Players because the technical director at our theater in Gannon in Erie, Pennsylvania, did all the scenery for John Tenley's shows. He was brilliant, brilliant thing.
Wow.
And a hell of a guy. And they were looking for somebody for Little Abner with Dirk Benedict and Lucy Arnaz. But the woman at the switchboard at the communications department didn't tell me. They called on Friday. But she didn't tell me till Monday that I had a call from Kenley. And by that time, they had cast somebody else in that role. But I got in the next show that after that, Make a Million with McLean Stevenson. And that got me my equity card.
There you go.
And then when I moved to New York, there was all this talk about grandfathering you in. So I went over to Screen Actors Guild to get my SAG card with this Father Tom Smith, this priest friend of mine from Pittsburgh. And I had done, while I was at Catholic U, I saw on the bulletin board they wanted people to be Secret Service people for a movie they were shooting. So I went down and they picked me because I had a nice suit. And I had three words in the film. Phone it in. I got paid $1,500. I thought, this is the
nice.
Money, this is for me. So when I went to the SAG office, they said, oh, you don't need to be grandfathered. You can get your card because you were in Scorpio. And they said it'll be, what, $270 or something. And I said, oh, well, I don't have that. And Father Smith said, buy your SAG card for you.
Really?
Yep. So my SAG card was for me by Father Tom Smith in Pittsburgh.
What a nice blessing that was to receive.
And I met him in New York. I was in Erie. And he was visiting some kids that he had worked with in Chancery Lane Players. And we stayed at this hotel on West 73rd Street. And he went with me down to talk to the lady downstairs, Ann Sherwin. And she took a liking to me. And she said, well, we don't have anything available right now, but there will be a place opening up in July. I said, that would be perfect. So I got an apartment in New York City, a two-bedroom apartment from one interview.
Which never happens.
And I was there for 10 years.
Wow. So,
I mean,
okay, I can't even imagine.
Well, see, I'll tell you some too. When I was 18, and they send the diocesan vocation director in Covington would visit all the high schools trying to get guys to go be diocesan priests. And I said to this recruiter, I said, well, you know, Father, I'm thinking about joining the Marianists. And he said this to me, and I never forgot it. He said, if you go and stay 10 days, that's 10 days you've given entirely over to God, and he will never be outdone in generosity.
Wow.
And then you look at my life and I go, holy Mary, I've been so lucky. I've been so blessed. And I've really never had a bad experience. I mean, there's been lots of, like on the comeback, there was never a raised voice. There was never any sniff. You know, and I keep thinking, gee, I wish there were, because that would make interesting fodder, but sorry.
Yeah, it was just a great, great experience.
And then you mentioned my book. I've written over 91 plays. I have a lot of time on my hands. And And I have one book out. When we're offline or something, email me your address. I'll send you a copy of my anthology.
Because, oh, I love it.
A friend of mine who was in the Brothers with me, he left, got divorced, and was worked for Johnson & Johnson. And he said, Mike, I think you really ought to, put some of these in a book, and, you know, so they can be saved. So I did. And now, in a couple of months, I'll probably have volumes 2, 3, and 4 done.
Wow. So do you have a favorite style of writing or topic that you like to cover? It looks like you're pretty much across the board, but is there anything that just really calls out to you?
Well, no. I've often thought of that I like comedy, but it's comedy hard to write. I like serious stuff. I like historical things. I do a lot of research. In fact, I have a play that is going to be done in Erie, Pennsylvania in July, the end of July, July 28th, called Gertrude, Queen of Denmark. And it's everything that happens to Gertrude while Hamlet's on stage.
I hope this is a comedy.
No.
No.
No. No, it's not. No, it's
okay.
Not. It's very much in the Elizabethan tradition, or in the tradition
okay.
of Tom Stoppard, Rosencrantz, and Guildenstern are dead. And I have another play that I really like about where Michelangelo got the inspiration for the David. I have another one about the Sitwell family and them being English spies during World War II. I have a play I really like called Rampart Street Liturgies. It takes place right around the Civil War in New Orleans, and it's about the street where all the white Creole gentlemen kept their black mistresses. And right now it's very timely, I think. And it's really a wonderful play, I think. But I do my research. I like doing research. I did a one-woman show about Anna Magnani, and boy, did I have to. There's no biographies of her. So I had to read a lot of stuff about Rossellini and people.
So
I have another one-woman show about Alice Roosevelt Longworth.
How do you pick the topics, though? Do you just, like, throw a dart at an encyclopedia and say, oh, I'm going to go, oh, today's Alice Roosevelt Longworth?
No. I don't pick the topics.
Okay.
I don't know where it's coming from. I've been working on one. It's gestating, I like to say now. It's about John Singer Sargent, the portrait painter, called Medium of Expression. I have a title. I started it. I've done a lot of research on it. So I haven't been able to go back into it. When it's ready, it will come out.
Okay.
But the play picks me. It's almost sometimes kind of a mystical experience, not automatic writing, but it gets it out there, and then you can go back and shape it and drop things and add things and make it more dramatic. I have a really nice play called Carpe Diem about child molestation. All kinds. I'm all over the place with stuff. I went through a very religious phrase, too. So.
I am so fascinated by you, Michael. And you know what? Our time is up. We're done. The hour has flown by. I have so much more I want
That's
to talk to you about.
And
I think I need to have you back.
Well, I'll say, listen, I'm not doing anything right now.
Okay. So I'm going to shoot you over some dates. And I want to go to lunch. I'm assuming you're in, like, the Southern California area, right?
I'm in Paramount, which is a little town between Los Angeles and Long Beach.
Well, I'm in Huntington Beach, so we're practically neighbors. Okay, so
yeah,
we're going to sit down and we're going to go to lunch, but I'm going to get you back on the show.
Okay.
Everybody, it's been Robert Michael Morris. He is the star of The Comeback and Running Wild, and he's been on Arrested Development and Brothers and Sisters and Sally Field. He really, really likes her. And everything else. We're going to get him back on the show, and I can't begin to thank him enough for coming on to Radigy Radio tonight. I'm going to play a little song by Kafir, who's going to be our guest on the Friday Night Dance Party tomorrow night live, an early start time at 5 p.m. Pacific Coast time. So tune in then. This is Kafir, and don't ask me why. We'll see you live on Friday.
Listening to Rated G Radio.